The Dream Team tapes Season 2. Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team is a production of Divergent Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio.
The players selected for the honor of representing the United States in the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games are Kobe Bryant.
We look forward to this for a while, you know, to be in this position now, to be able to, you know, represent our country, man. It's special, special.
LeBron James.
We look for the opportunity of rekindling that flame of being the best in the world. I guess the Redeem Team is right.
We the best team in the world. We the best team in the world. We put basketball, American basketball, where it's supposed to be, which is at the top.
Welcome to Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. This is the second part of a discussion that J.A. Adondi and I had with two notable hoops chroniclers, Jeff Van Gundy and Zach Lowe. We pick it up with J.A. talking about this season's crazy, compacted NBA schedule.
I want to go back, Zach. You talked about how the league, or just how crazy it's going to be this year with the turnaround from finishing the finals to basically going ahead right over to Tokyo for the Olympics. One of the reasons that they did go for the schedule is the way it is this year is because they wanted to finish in time and they had to pack all these games in time to do the Olympics. But we've seen the price that's being paid in all these injuries and you could argue diminished quality of play as well. And Zach, I'm wondering through reporting, I know these type of things come up, what this means long term for the future and are there any serious discussions about shortening the number of games? Obviously, there would have to be huge financial concessions to do so. But is it starting to reach the point where the concerns about the physical toll being taken on bodies and improving the quality of the product would be worth it to make that financial sacrifice?
I feel like that's been a semi-serious discussion for 10 years, but it never actually gets serious. Like, I feel like we've had the same just like, oh, Adam Silver is like, you know, he's open to it. You know, we're just everything's on the table in the league office. And it's like, and then, oh, the money. And so we just sort of keep running the boulder up the same hill and nothing is going to ever happen. I think it's a discussion worth having. And I there has to be some financial modeling that can show that scarcity would have some sort of power. Maybe you can increase ticket prices. Maybe viewership increases if there are fewer games. But this season, you know, everyone wants to connect the trend line of, you know, the compressed schedule to an increase in injuries. I mean, the league will tell you there is no increase in injuries, but you also see teams just holding guys out of games, you know, holding guys out of back-to-backs, trying to stop guys from playing 4 and 5 and three and four, whatever it is. So this season's been tough. And we've Donovan Mitchell just got hurt right before we came on this podcast. Like, thankfully, it doesn't seem to be more than an ankle sprain, maybe a severe ankle sprain, but yeah, I think this discussion is going to keep going. And if you put a gun to my head, I think in 20 years or 15 years, the NBA is not going to be playing 82 games. But maybe I'm naive. I don't know.
Well, for me, the answer is, I don't care what the question is in pro sports, the answer is money. So like if they're asked, if the owners are asked or the players are asked or the league is asked to take one less dollar, it's not happening. And that's just how it is. It's, you know, at the end of the day, and I agree with Zach, like this schedule is insane this year. When you can't physically practice, you don't have any days. They call protocols or whatever they call it, but the rules of testing, you land at 2 a.m. You have to be back to test at 10, you know, we were talking about sleep doctors, you know, 3 years ago. Now no one cares about sleep because of money. And so the whole thing, it's been one miserable experience this year. It really has, all in the name of money. And the problem going forward is next year is going to be impacted too, because it's going to be a shorter offseason. Like, they're going to have to start at the right time. And only after next season are they going to be able to get back into a normal rhythm of draft, summer league, September, you know, start in October and play a normal 82 game schedule. So I feel for these players, you know, and I am the biggest anti-load management, play every game you're healthy to play. But this year, I completely understand why teams are doing what they're doing. Now, some players and teams overdo it and they just don't like playing. I've never seen more personal days ever taken in NBA. I don't know what's happening, but like, there was never a personal day taken like in my time coaching in the NBA. Like, not like, maybe it would be called personal day if a guy missed for the birth of his child. But now, like, we had guys who would go to the birth of their child on the same day and come back and play. Now that doesn't happen. So there's a lot more personal days too. And they're not, you know, you don't know what the personal issues are.
Well, and to the point of this podcast, can you imagine making the NBA finals? Like, all right, we won the championship. Yes. I got to get on a plane to Japan right now because my international team needs it. I mean, it's going to be, and then I get back from the Olympics. It's like, oh my God, training camp starts in three weeks.
No, it will happen. Whoever wins the finals, if they decide to take people from that last round, will at most have 24 hours, I would say.
Yeah. I think we can all agree that, it's, you know, Jeff alluded to it in the beginning, that it's really different coaching national teams. Chuck Daly, let's face it, I love Chuck, the great late Chuck Daly, but coaching a dream team, a little bit of a vacation. It got harder. Mike Krzyzewski had to make some changes. So I wonder, Jeff, and both you and Zach can reflect on this, back when they were choosing a coach, and this was, maybe this wasn't interesting to anybody else, but a couple people mentioned right away that it was more natural to get a college coach to coach that team. And back then it was either going to be Krzyzewski or Pop. We're talking about 2005, this is. That it was more natural to get a college coach because the pro coach would bring too much recrimination. Hey, something happened invariably. He called one of the guys that's going to be playing a punk or something happened between their...
Con man is the word to use, Jeff's words.
Yeah, con man, yeah. So I found that interesting because it was the exact opposite when it first started, this idea of pros and international play, which was, oh my God, they're not going to listen to a college guy. So bringing it to Pop, it could have just been specific to Pop because he's such, let's just say, a strong personality. But it was a little bit counterintuitive to many people when Mike Krzyzewski got picked over Greg Popovich. So any thoughts on that, Zach or Jeff?
Well, I would say that you couldn't go wrong. I always say when you get into these debates of who do you want, who would you start a team with? Like, you can go first, I'll go second, I'll be fine with whoever else it is. It's the same with that coaching decision. I think, you know, think about the greatness of Mike Krzyzewski that Jerry Colangelo would even consider a college coach to do that. And then think about the greatness of Greg Popovich to be bypassed for that long for a national team honor to coach the team, be such a great representative of the NBA through winning and his comportment and his, you know, all the things he brings, and to still be honored and humbled to assume that role when Mike Krzyzewski, you know, stepped down. So, you know, what it shows me is that since, let's start with from the dream team, you know, Chuck Daly, I mean, we've had these incredible coaches. I think the one that gets overlooked as much as any is Rudy Tomjanovich and the job he did in the World Cup when he had no NBA players, and then the Olympics. I mean, we have just been blessed with amazing, amazing national team coaches.
The interesting thing about Pop is you know, obviously there's going to be NBA players on Team USA, but the more NBA coaches there are on the staff and the more NBA trainers there are on the staff and health people, you said, and this is very relevant for the Redeem team from at least the player side, you start to hear the grumbling from other people around the NBA who aren't there being like, well, are those guys getting a competitive advantage? Like they're getting to know the star players, they're getting cushy with the best player. Oh, that guy's going to be a free agent in 2 years. Is this going to matter? And people start connecting dots, even if the dots aren't really there, they're just kind of hazy little spots. But you know, it's the sort of mythology of the Redeem team leading to the Heatles. I think the Heat players will tell you that's been a little overblown, but it's never going to go away.
Hey, look, if I somehow end up in the NBA and I'm in Japan this year, you can bet my ass is going to be, well, I don't know what your word is, cozying up to all the star players. Like, you're going to take advantage of every advantage that you have in competition, every legal advantage. And, you know, people said the same thing about Mike Krzyzewski. Did he have an innate recruiting advantage because he coached these national teams? Well, maybe he did, but I don't begrudge that. You're going to take advantage of anything you have. So,
and you're going to take Mason Plumlee on Team USA every damn time, no matter what.
Hey, you're going to do what you got to do. And guess what? If Curry's on the national team and he was, I don't know, is he a free agent coming up?
Not that, potentially after next season, but he's extension eligible now.
Okay. Guess what? If James Borrego was on the staff, because he was, you know, Pop's assistant at one time, he's going to be sucking up to Steph Curry like no get out. That's just how it works.
Come home. Come back to Charlotte, your hometown.
You've already done everything in the Bay Area. Come on, man. Yeah.
Jeff, you were with Pat Riley's staff in the 90s when he certainly would have been under consideration for a Team USA. Why did Pat Riley, he's one of the great coaches that did not coach the men's national team. Do you know why that did or why that did not happen?
I mean, they had Chuck Daly, so, you know, and I think, If I'm just guessing here, but I would think back then, wasn't the commissioner pretty much in charge of picking who the coach?
Yeah, it was Stern, and I guess.
Yeah, Rod Thorne. We had a little bit of like some animosity going on back then. I think that would be one. And I think second, they might worry that, which I think was unfounded, that he would work the players too hard, you know. He wouldn't be out golfing with them, you know. So, but I think it was probably, you know, they had other great options, obviously. Chuck Daly, man, what a great coach. Yeah, still one of the great lines ever is his job as a coach is to coach, is to land the plane through turbulence. You know, that's his job. And like he was great. But I think the animosity was real. You forget, Rod Thorne used to work out in our weight room at the Knicks. Like, think about this. The head of discipline used to, because he lived right next to our, very close to our practice facility back then. He had a key to our work, you know, like, you know, these weren't like spacious or spectacular workout rooms either. This was like, you know, early 90s. He used to work out there. And then when Riley came in, that was closed off, right? So no more Team Nick. We're all in it together. We weren't in it together. And so there was some, you know, there was a little bit of, let's just say, animosity that continued on through that next decade. So it was real. And you know, I know they think they were objective, but, you know, in some cases we thought they maybe lacked objectivity.
Well, that was the brilliance of Chuck Daly. Chuck Daly got the job, even though he coached the most hated team, the most hated team of that era. And only Chuck could have waded his way through that maelstrom of hatred toward, you know, Isaiah and Ricky Mahorn and Lambeer and those guys. It's one of the great Machiavellian, if we can put it on that, one of the great feats, political feats of all time. And then skirt the issue of Isaiah not being on the team also. But this is completely old news. Go ahead, Jay. You were going to say something.
Jack, I was just going to say that those hard feelings followed Pat Riley down to Miami in the infamous Juwan Howard case when they signed Juwan Howard and then the league voided that free agent contract because they said that they had underestimated the amount of salary cap space they had. And then Pat Riley on a conference call came up with the all-time classic line. He says, The only thing we underestimated was the extent of the league's animus towards us. I'll never forget that one.
We're going to take a break for a minute, and we'll be right back with Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team.
We'll close on this note, a little bit more serious note, as we head toward and look forward to the Tokyo Games. And we've seen social justice and speaking out on the racial issues in our country interwoven with the NBA. For the bubble, certainly throughout the bubble with Black Lives Matter on the court, throughout the current season. And it's interesting to think that there could be the potential for something if Team USA were to win. Would there be some type of statement made during the playing of the national anthem, for example? And it's a very delicate road. And Jeff, again, given your experience with Team USA, coaching internationally, and the time you spent around the NBA, and I'm wondering if also you could speak to your brother has been very outspoken, Stan Van Gundy, on these issues, currently the coach of the New Orleans Pelicans. How do you think that would be navigated? We've seen the outspokenness of these players. We've seen how much it matters to them. And what do you think how would that play out given the international environment that you're familiar with from coaching Team USA as well?
Yeah, first of all, I think I'm so proud of Stan and those other coaches, Greg Popovich, Steve Kerr, many others, right? They were way before that. This wasn't a Johnny come lately this year. This has been ongoing. And so people can have their own opinions. You read the Twitter. I'm not a Twitter guy, but like Stan has some supporters. Some people come at him hard. But I love that he's unafraid of taking a stand. Same with the other coaches. I do think with the national team, it's a little different. I think I'd be surprised if any coach or player refrained from speaking about the issues that they believed in strongly. But if they took some stand at the Olympic Games, I would be surprised. Because I think, when you're playing for your team, I think it's just different. So not that they don't have the right, not that USA Basketball would ask them not to do something. I don't think they would do that, but I would be surprised if the focus is on other things other than the Olympic Games and the spirit of the Olympics. But I'm very proud that our players and our coaches, and more importantly, many of our owners are encouraging the expressions of or the freedom of expression to take stands and to even take criticism from others. I really am impressed with the owners now, and I think there's a lot of conservative owners that are still allowing, this freedom of expression. So like I said, the bubble was great. I was even more proud of the people that came before that and led the fight even before the bubble. So yeah, it's been good. And I'll be interested to see what happens with the national team. But I think the focus there will be just on the Olympics and the Olympic spirit in the competition.
Zach, where do you think the owners are at now? Jeff brought that up, and we have seen, who they've donated to politically, and they might not be outspoken, but follow the money, and you can see where their beliefs lie. And yet there's this, the players are tugging them in a different direction. And so where do you think the ownership and the power structure of the league stands on these matters now?
To me, that's going to be the most interesting moment, if it ever happens, is when a player who plays for a team whose governor is publicly on the other political side.
Happened in the WNBA for sure, in Atlanta.
Well, that's right.
They ran her out.
She's not there anymore. Will something like the Kelly Loeffler thing ever happen in the NBA? I guess it happened with Donald Sterling, but that was Donald Sterling brought that upon himself, and it reached a point of such disgustingness that it was sort of unavoidable. But I agree with everything Jeff said. As far as where the owners are, I think they're just sort of, you know, even if I'm sure there are still some governors who would prefer that the players keep politics. I mean, it's not even politics. It's basic human rights and decency, but call it whatever you want. Would prefer the players just focus on basketball and sports, but also know on a pragmatic level, it's a losing battle for them to try to keep the players to focus just on sports and basketball, that they'll end up looking so bad anyway. But there are some, I think, who are, you know, hey, it's their right. I might disagree with it, but we're built on freedom of expression of ideas. And then there are a lot who are fully supportive of everything that the players are talking about.
Yeah. And I think, Zach, the one thing I'll be interested in, you said, you know, does it ever come to pushing a governor out or an owner out? I forget what the politically correct term is right now, but I think what I'm interested in, does it ever become the deciding factor in a free agency? Like, you know, I have owner A and owner B, and I say, you know, I picked owner A, even though he was offering less money, because I couldn't do this because, like you said, Jafe, I followed the money. He may not be outspoken, but it goes so counter to my beliefs that I just can't do it. I'm very interested to see if that ever comes about, or if it just continues to be all about legacy and money.
To me, it doesn't even have to come to that or to forcing an owner out. I didn't even mean to imply that. I just meant that, like, if you played, I mean, just name a team. You played for the Orlando Magic. You could start a dialogue anytime you wanted about the DeVos family and what they stand for. I mean, at any game you wanted, you could start that dialogue. I mean, it's just sitting there waiting to happen. And again, Jeff, I mean, we even saw there were all these, what the situation you talked about will, I think we'll hear rumblings of that at some point for sure.
We're going to take a break for a minute and we'll be right back with Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. I just got to ask all three of you one more question, because this morning I invariably get one of my friends, you know, I watched the Portland Denver game last night. They shot 92 threes. They made 17 of them. Why the hell am I watching? So the effect of the Curry effect, I guess I'm just asking in general, the state of the game, because everybody always asks me, because I go back to, I mean, people were thinking I was watching Dolph Schayes hit the overhead set shot. Actually, I did see some of that, by the way. But I just, yeah, you know, I used to see the Syracuse Nats in a doubleheader at the at Convention Hall. Nevertheless, I watched I keep saying the skill level of the players today is a joke. It is so high, but it doesn't always translate to something that traditional fans want to see, which is, you know, the game. So just briefly, if you can, all three of you, the state of the game as you see it now, and why it's still a great game, just to weight the argument one way or the other. Zach?
I think the game is really fun. I think the idea that NBA teams don't play defense is absolutely ridiculous. Playing defense in the NBA is really, really hard right now with how much ground you have to cover, let alone all the rule changes and emphases that Jeff talked about before that are meant to benefit perimeter offensive players and all that. I do think we are approaching a saturation point, or may already be there, where for some fans, and maybe not for younger fans, maybe we're all of us here are too old to really feel how a 22-year-old processes the league, but where the game is too much just about who made more threes, who was hot that night, you know. But you look at every box score, 17 of whatever from three, 9 of whatever. No, the 17 team won. That's it. That's the whole game. And, you know, we could go off on a million tangents about it, and people have proposed lots of different solutions or ways you could tweak the rules to make sure that the game isn't all about threes. But three is just fundamentally so much more than two that I don't see an end in sight for teams evolving in that direction. And yeah, it presents challenges for defenses, and it's interesting to see how they respond to it. But it's every game now, a three-on-one is ending in a pull-up three instead of a dunk. And there are three guys in the league who can post up with any sort of efficiency that trumps just driving and kicking to, like, pick a random average three-point shooter. This Solomon Hill shooting an above-the-break three is a better option than the, like, LaMarcus Aldridge doing anything, God bless him, on the left elbow or something. But that saturation point has probably already been breached, and I don't think we're going – I don't think it's the reversing of that trend is happening without some engineering of the rules by the NBA.
Mark Jackson always says styles make fights, differing styles. And Daryl Morey said the other day that the GM of the 76ers, you need to look at a system where there's only one way to win. And that's, you know, shooting threes. And I think he nailed it. I find the proliferation of the three, like you said, Jack, I think the skill is off the charts. The, like, just average players, what they can do with the ball, the range they can shoot with, you know, you could make it a 4-point shot. I mean, it's amazing. And yet I don't find the 3-point shot as exciting as plays at the rim. So going to Zach's, you know, 3-on-1, 3-on-2, I love, like, when a guy challenges another guy at the rim, and you don't see that as much because they get in there and they spray it out. Sometimes taking what is an outstanding shot and making it into just a very good shot, you know, because the layup and the free throw are still, you know, the best shots. But so I'm concerned with it. I don't find it at times, like, I think you're watching the same game no matter what the opponents are. And it just, it takes away some of, you know, the variety of play that I always found intriguing. And I agree with Zach that it's going to be up to the rules and engineering it such that to, if you want to bring a little bit more balance and a little bit different styles to the game.
Yeah, I agree. The aesthetics of it, I'm not a fan of, but I'm a fan of the health of basketball because of the great talents and the array of talents, much more so than in any of the previous four decades that I've been watching it. And part of that is a legacy of the Dream Team and all the international talent that it created and the interest in basketball around the world that that team created. And I love the fact that there's a Giannis and a Luka and a Nikola Jokic. And so I love the state of the NBA from that regard. And it's a very good, healthy place, I think, in that state. Keeping those players healthy is the key. Going back to our discussion about the schedule and what could be done about protecting player health and mental health as well. You just wonder, though, if and I think it'll happen, Coach. Like, I think we'll have a player that makes it zag, right? We had Steph Curry come along. If and when another Shaquille O'Neal comes along, maybe it does tilt back to running the offense through the low post and a powerful inside player. There just hasn't been another thing like Shaq. And there aren't a lot of Shaqs out there, but there was a Wilt Chamberlain, and you could argue Shaq was his descendant, and maybe someone will descend from Shaq, although his literal descendant is funny. I saw his son played for my high school where I went to high school, and he didn't go inside the paint at all. So even Shaq's own offspring played the modern game of a perimeter game. But I think someone will come along to shift it. But until then, I do think the talent throughout the league keeps it in a pretty good place.
Well, we could have gone on forever, and J.A. and I can't thank Jeff Van Gundy and Zach Lowe enough for their opinions, observations, and inside knowledge, not to mention their endurance and hanging with us for well over an hour. Part one of this discussion is available, as is the entire season of Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. J.A. Adodney and I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we've enjoyed recording it. I'm Jack McCallum.
I'm J.A. Adande.
And thanks again for listening. The Dream Team Tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, is a production of Diversion Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This season is written and hosted by me, Jack McCallum, and J.A. Adonde. Executive producers Scott Waxman and Mark Francis for Diversion Podcast and Sean Titone for iHeartRadio. Our editorial director is John Tuttle. Supervising producer Brian Murphy. Legal producer Freddie Overstegen. Editing, mixing, and sound design by Mark Francis. Verna Fields is our technical producer, and our director of marketing and business development is Jacob Bronstein.
Diversion Podcasts.